Hello, everybody. This is Charlie Swenson.
This is Kelly.
Kelly Kerner. And usually we start this hour called Connecting the Dots with an introduction by somebody else, but Kelly and I have just decided to fly with it ourselves, for better or worse. So, you ready to go, Kelly?
I'm ready, yeah.
I don't think we have any elaborate introduction, but we're really, really glad you're here. And I do want to say, and maybe you saw what the title of this is, and usually the title is kind of a loose prompt for us to just get going, and sometimes we stay more with it than others. But what we thought was that since we both attended the Association for Behavior and Cognitive Therapy annual meeting, ABCT, and which also was paired with the Is It DBT meeting, Improvement, what's it called? International for Society for Improvement and Teaching of DBT, which is once a year, associated with the same meeting. And both of us went this year, and we just thought ahead of time, let's see what we learned there. Let's see what we think's interesting there. What's some cool stuff that we come across, and just talk about it.
Yeah.
I think each of us will probably have some things.
Yeah, and I know we went to different things, so I'm actually real excited to hear the sorts of things you went to.
No, I kept seeing you in different places, and you were always going somewhere other than where I was going. Except for the one workshop we did together, and so I wondered, where are you going all the time?
Heard some fantastic talks on dissemination and implementation science. So
yeah.
I think some of what I would like to share are things that had implication for training therapists, and what should you train them in, and how do you keep it sustainable, and maybe some ideas about how some of the health care changes that will come with Obamacare may have implications for us all.
Oh,
and the other thing I heard that I got just some kind of cool tips, like just phrases, was from Elizabeth Hembry in a workshop on prolonged exposure that she called Beyond Habituation. And there were just some really, nice little clinical nuggets that I would share from that, I think. How about you?
Oh, well, you went to things that I wanted to. You know, there's just so much that went on there. And as you know, any of you who went, you would know this was the most bizarre place to go that I've ever been for a conference. It was so unusual. It was called National Harbor, Maryland, and I thought that probably meant it was in Baltimore, but it wasn't. Then I thought it's probably at D.C., but it's kind of outside of D.C., and it's like a completely artificial town almost, constructed around the idea of having a Las Vegas-type hotel and conference center, and so it was really weird finding things. Anyway, that's a side note. I went to a lot of different things, and I've sort of found myself in thinking about this tonight, just kind of like where there are a few individual things that I thought were interesting and maybe I'd just share with you, and then also what I see stepping back as the theme of how things are evolving as the evolution of DBT unfolds, the treatment of people with borderline personality disorder and in the larger sense, people with emotional dysregulation problems. I think that there are some themes you can see if you step back and see what's being presented. And then there are some specific studies that I thought, new stuff, interesting stuff. Such as the randomized controlled trial of the treatment of adolescents with DBT that was presented, and the data was presented for the first time, and this is the first ever randomized controlled trial. So it was kind of like a groundbreaking moment on Saturday when this was presented from Lars Mellum from Norway. So I want to say just to make sure that gets on the agenda, because that's huge. And then there were just a few other things. One really neat thing, Kelly, was just I was at a talk where, as part of a discussion, Jerry Davison, Marsha Linehan's mentor, basically in behavior therapy, he gave a lovely kind of discussion of at a panel, and one of the things he said was, you know, we used to be the AABT, Association for the Advancement of Behavior Therapy, for a long time, and then after long debates, the C was allowed into the title, AAA, so it became the ABCTs, because cognitive therapy came in alongside behavior therapy. And then he said, you know, then along came the Buddhists and the dialecticians. And he says, now I think we're just about where we're going to be the ABCDT with dialectics, the Association of Behavior and Cognitive Dialectical Therapy coming in. So that was just kind of cool. I actually think it was sort of a joke, and it was also sort of true, the third wave of therapies that have come along.
So no, I think of that. Hey, Charlie,
what?
Just a quick thinking on that. Just like I still call it accidentally and sometimes on purpose, AABT. And I think that the focus, one of the focus was on emotion, some of the stuff that's really coming out. And so to me, if we could go back to that more fundamental, in some ways the third wave is about that, the more fundamental viewing all of what we do as behavior instead of this parsing up, that would make me so happy.
Well,
just,
you know,
a little aside there.
Well, it's a more than a little aside. I mean, when I get back and just say that what I see as evolving over time is I think there is a return in two directions. One huge is how many things are now being looked at through the lens of emotion regulation. Just all over this conference and the literature, increasing numbers of things, you know, are not just putting emotion regulation alongside lots of other things that are sort of much more central and having treatments to it. And another thing is, yes, all of behavior being behavior, all different kinds of behavior being behavior, and the term skills, as I told you earlier, I wanted to spend a little bit of time tonight really brainstorming with you about what is going on in the evolution where I think that skills and the understanding of skills as a skills training as a core component of DBT is getting more emphasis. It's as if kind of like finding Jesus, you know, back in the skills training of DBT. It's like Jesus, the skills. It's like, wow, everything is coming back to skills. And a couple of workshops I went to that were really interesting about just sort of looking at the impact of skills, even without any DBT psychotherapy or other therapies. But I have some thoughts about that I want to get back to, about what skills are.
Okay, that sounds good. So that would fit, too, with some of the exposure stuff that I've been hearing.
All right. So why don't you go back? Since I missed entirely, I mean, one of my major interests in life is implementation, and I just hardly got to things. So could you just go over some of what you found interesting about implementation stuff?
Yeah, and let's keep good track of time, because I want to hear, I'd love to do some meaningful toggle back and forth here, because I'd rather hear you than me in some ways.
I know, we're overstuffed here already.
We are. Like,
just take a breath.
All right. So I got to say, one of the cool things that happened was a pre-conference. So before that ABCT conference, the Dissemination Implementation Science Special Interest Group met, and they met in the afternoon. And that was a fantastic group of people, one of whom was Bruce Chorpita. He and a number of colleagues have been looking at how do you improve treatment and routine settings for kids, like the state of Hawaii and other really large systems, and how do you go about that? And one of the things he talked about was the way in which sometimes academics who are doing this type of research maybe lose track and start to think of dissemination or implementation as the goal, as opposed to it being a strategy. You know, that the goal really is to improve people's lives. And that got echoed in a couple of other talks that I heard as well from Alan Kasdan and Kimberly Hogwood. But this kind of idea of let's measure our actual impact rather than get attached to the in what Kimberly Hogue would call the increasingly proprietary way that things are getting sort of sent out as a, you know, set in stone package that can't be modified by the setting. And I think that there, to me, there is a sea change happening that might be accelerated even by some of the changes coming from Obamacare and the economic impacts of how things will be changing for us all. So
what
I think,
Kelly, what do you mean by, I don't think I had thought about this this quite this way. Like implementation, I pretty much, I'm not sure I ever think of it as anything other than, really, it rises or falls, it changes, it's flexed, it's created and measured only with respect to whether it generates like what you were hoping to affect in a system, like the outcomes that you wanted. So I always think of it as a set of strategies, but how is it you mean that it becomes a goal in itself?
I think that some of the ways in which measures and strategies for implementation and training studies and sustainability, there's a way, I think this might be a difference between you as somebody who's actually living in a system, goes about things and thinks about things versus, say, somebody who's doing academic research. I think there's just a bit of a disconnect with the realities. Like another really interesting thing I heard, I was discussing on a panel, and Amy Herschel presented some data about turnover. And they did a fantastic training study, really high-quality training, got people up to speed. But what happened is in all but two of the agencies, these are regular old community mental health agencies, they had amazing turnover, up to 60% in some of the places. And so, you know, as an administrator, you invest those dollars and then your people train up and leave. And it turned out that the reason they left is they could get higher paid work now that they were skilled up.
Right.
And I think about, you know, if you really, as a person doing training and implementation, if you really think of that sustainability problem and the pressures on systems, I think it might change how we look at the outcomes. Like, could be we would go to a population-based way of looking at, did we change the availability, the reach, rather than did we train this therapist? Maybe we think, how does that therapist move through that whole population to have an impact? So anyway, just in terms of how you design the research as a scientist, you know, if you think of it as your goal to get it even implemented, you may not link up to the client outcomes in the way that you need to.
You know,
so I think it was really interesting.
I think it does. When you said, you know, as someone who's living in a system, I mean, what you mean by that is, you know, the public sector. I mean, my day in, day out work is in the public sector, and being being a medical senior psychiatrist in Western and Central Massachusetts in the public sector system, in that as well as my DBT work and team and stuff. And I think this is, it really does, it's, I sort of have a repeat, what would you call this? What's that word? I have a thing. It isn't the word. I can't think of the word. I have a pet peeve. That's it. I have a pet peeve about this, and it sort of goes along these lines, is that when people get when people get excited about, here is a package, here is how, like, for instance, in my work, and coming down from Boston, is a whole set, a new set of forms, tools, strategies that are actually very well informed, very smart, very well laid out about how you identify and prepare for unsafe behaviors in the community. Sort of just, there's been a lot of iterations of these things. And the same way people get ready with DBT programs or with panic disorder programs, and then they export them into the community. The thing that I've seen for my 15 years in my current work, and I've seen it elsewhere, is that the thing that I see not working over and over again, but you have to be there to know it doesn't work and know why, is that a great package is sent your way, and you're supposed to do it, but it isn't done in real time. They haven't created. You have to flex it. You know how you wrote a chapter once, and I was second author on this, about adapting versus adopting DBT. It's really like every day things happen that huge packages, great ideas of implementation, can be brought to their knees in a minute. Mm-hmm. For instance, I was once involved in an implementation of DBT in an inpatient program in Detroit, and we put a lot of work, Shireen and Rizvi and I, into this, and we went there several times. And a lot of people worked hard, and it was great, great people to work with. And it got down to, are they going to really do DBT in this place or not? And what it was really coming down to on a given day, in a given meeting, was that the nursing staff, even though the head nurse and the second head nurse were all in favor of it, it was clear just looking at people's faces in the room that that they were not won over. They were not going to do this. In fact, they were a little pissed off. You could tell they were not happy about this. And as I looked a little closer, I noticed they all seemed to be taking their cues from one particular nurse who was not the head nurse. She was a nurse and maybe thought of as the most competent nurse in the whole group. But she was quiet. She worked really hard. She really won her respect. And everybody seemed to take their cues. Is she going to go with this or not? And you could just see her sitting back there with her arms folded, figuring it out. And I realized, if she doesn't go with this, it's going to be a less effective implementation, and the patients are not going to get it the way they're supposed to. So, I've gotten really interested. This is where my own work in implementation, my next step, and I actually put in a submission for the Seattle Implementation Research Conference next year, and it got approved to present kind of case studies of sagas of implementation. You know, what really makes or breaks it? And so I think this idea that you really always have to be thinking of keeping your eye on making it happen, not keeping your eye on doing it the way the implementation guidelines say, you know, or the way the training says, you know, it's kind of like you have to adapt way more than just sort of cutting the edges to make it fit in. I mean, you have to really bring it alive. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's making me think of this other really great study, Project Match. This is the first, I'll give Perry the citation on this one, but this is Bob Weiss and Torpeda. And again, there's a core group who've been doing this with therapies for children, but this one actually shows that the data support a more modular approach. So in this one, they have a modular approach to therapy for children, and for it, they targeted anxiety, depression, and conduct problems in this in this study, and they randomly assigned therapists to do things flexibly. They had a training program where you teach them all the kind of modular elements that are common across these cognitive behavioral therapies, across anxiety, depression, conduct, or you give them manuals, you know, kind of by-the-book packages for each of those individual problems, or you just let you randomly assign people to do usual care. And what was fascinating to me is that, in fact, the flexible group, the one who could do the modular, had better outcomes on nearly everything. So to me, that and you couldn't really, in some cases, you couldn't really distinguish the manual in terms of its treatment effectiveness from usual care. So if I'm reading that study, I actually had some friends double check I was not overstating, but the fact that you can train therapists how to do a modular approach, and they can get...
What do you mean modular?
Good.
How do you...
Modular means, if you think about what do you do that's common across, say, coping CAT, which is a treatment for anxiety, primary and secondary control enhancement training, which is a treatment for depression, and then defiant children, which is one for conduct disorder. You look at what are the elements that are common across all of those treatments? Mm-hmm. A lot is common, you know, in terms of what you're actually doing. And so if you give the therapist the training so they know how to do each of those elements, but they know how to combine them to match, you know, multi-problem kids' problems, that ends up making the therapist more satisfied with the learning, but also, more importantly, gets better outcomes than, say, doing a standardized manual. I just think that's interesting. It sort of supports, to me, it supports a flexible, still coherent and principled but flexible approach to treatment. That was really interesting.
Well, you know, I find that that does parallel what I'm saying about implementation. That when you implement, you have to be smart. You have to know treatment, and you have to not only know how a system works, but you want to know the people in the system. You can't just drop leaflets down and say, start doing this, because it's so beautifully packaged. I mean, you have to have such buy-in, and you have to modify it as you go in. And yet, I think this, for instance, in DBT, there are so many elements to the package. I mean, there's the four miss rule. There's the rule about not calling your therapist if you've hurt yourself. There's the rules about observing limits. There's all the rules about following the agreements and so on. And I think what I find over and over again, my guess is you do too, in supervisions as well as in consulting to programs, is that what makes you really good at this and what makes you really bring it and change it as needed at the moment that it's needed is you know it, but also what you really know is the functions of each of the things you're doing. Mm-hmm. So that, the function of the four miss rule in DBT or the function of the 24-hour rule or the function of being in a skills group. I mean, with skills, for instance, I think people have gotten so sold on skills, DBT skills groups, that sometimes we forget that what really is what matters, if anything matters, is that people practice skills in their lives, that it gives them more things to do at moments that they just fall reflexively back in what they've learned. And so they have to learn things to do. Now, how do you learn things to do? You might learn it by listening to a story. You might learn it by a metaphor that somebody says. You might learn it by watching someone do it. You might learn it because you watched a movie one day and it hit the spot exactly. You might learn it from your individual therapist when they actually help you with something. And they might learn it in a skills group. But I think the way in which skills training has come to mean a skills group, I mean, is a problem. A big
problem.
Well,
tell me, what did you hear? What did you hear by way of all the different presentations or data?
Well, for one thing, I went to a big a series of presentations that were all grouping together the different studies that show that skills only is not really skills only, but skills only meaning skills, DBT skills training without DBT individual therapy. That there are, 10 randomized controlled trials in which that goes on, including for eating disorders, substance abuse, the elderly, depressed, and then a number of more specific ones that have been designed just to test this hypothesis that how much is it that skills are the core component of what really matters? So the dismantling kind of studies. So these were presented. Were you at that one?
No, I missed it. Go for it.
There were a lot of these presented, and some of them were from people in Seattle. Some of them were not. And what was interesting to me, and I'd have to look at a more careful look of all the different studies because I'd like to line them up, read them all next to each other, and think about it further. But at first it sounded like, oh, God, look at all of the evidence that teaching skills changes how people, regulate emotions, how people's anxiety, people's depression, and to some degree people's behavior, like suicidal or self-injurious behaviors or substance abuse. And so you see all of this data, and then you look at it, and one of the more interesting studies to me was one in which it doesn't prove a thing about whether skills training itself helps. What it does show is a reliable association between whether people practice skills and whether their symptoms or other targeted behaviors change. And how they got the skills is entirely another question. And the reason that's interesting to me is that, in my all the long work that I've done in DBT work, individual therapy, skills training, I see people go through skills training and seem to do great at the skills training. And if I ask them later what skills they know they have, they sometimes don't know. They can't say them anymore. And
yeah.
and I don't know if they changed. And I've watched my own children go through learning to play hockey, both of them to a ton of hockey. And I've watched a lot of training. And, you know, they have these hockey skills clinics. But actually, I know with one of my boys that I've seen his game incorporate new skills based on one conversation on the bench in between shifts on the ice from a coach who knew what he was doing, like maybe four sentences, changed him, you know, more than any other, more than going to a camp that's focused on that, you know. So I just think we have to unhook. It's kind of another version of what you're saying. I do think skills training is huge, though I'm getting increasingly confused, and hopefully this will lead to increasingly organized. But I have one of those times when, you know, how you get more disorganized before you actually figure something out. And,
because exactly.
I'm having a hard time thinking about what isn't a skill. I mean, cognitive therapy seems to just be a set of skills. You know, how to recognize categorize and change and come up with a new thought that's more helpful and that's less rigid. So that's all skills. You know, exposure. Treatment seems to me to be just a complex collection of skills, along with, you know, preventing yourself from escaping situations, response prevention, even contingency management seems like it's teaching, by reinforcing people to do certain things, it's teaching them what should be reinforced, and teaching them, in a sense, to discover reinforcement for those behaviors in the world. And even behavioral assessment seems to be the skill of helping people understand how to look more thoughtfully at themselves so that they can do it on their own as well. So I've started to think, well, of course it's skills that change people. It's all there is. I mean, but I think I'm probably missing something. But you know what I mean? The boundary has gotten a little to where, and people are talking about skills a lot as if there's skills, and then there's these other things that we do in psychosocial interventions.
Well, so I think it's a really great point. So the two things I'm hearing you say that would be worth just anchoring again for myself. One is making sure as we read these studies and think about it that we're not conflating learning skills rehearsal with skills training, that those are not one and the same. That's really a key point. But this other about how you define it, it's making me think the other construct that's getting a lot more play right alongside emotion regulation is experiential avoidance and the concept of moving towards psychological flexibility. That fits up with the exposure research where it looks like it's more, can you be in the presence of high emotion and develop the ability to do something else? And the more you cultivate that ability to not just do the one habitual fear response or the one habitual shame response or anger response, but to get some more flexibility in responding, that I think, you know, there's a stretch of time where DBT was taught as it's all exposure, response, prevention, opposite action. I actually do think there's something about simplified version as behavioral rehearsal. How much, if we had one little process measure, like how much does this therapist get their client doing something different? I bet that would predict a lot of outcome.
Well, I think pretty much most therapy, most of people's change in their lives as a result of therapy seems to come about by articulating one pathway that seems to have negative consequences or isn't all of what somebody would want in their life, and then articulating an alternative pathway, and then helping the person try out that alternative pathway and one way or another, finding out and possibly, you know, acquiring that second pathway. And I think that it sort of parallels what you're saying. So much of treatment, whether it's learning a new skill or whether it's doing formal exposure therapy for PTSD or whether you do as I did when I went to a behavior therapist to try to get less compulsive in preparation for giving talks a long time ago, my first experience with behavior therapy was, you know, basically he got me to do different, to approach a talk to a group of people with less and less preparation until I did it with no preparation, with sheer terror. I mean, I guarantee you, sheer terror, standing in front of people in northern Italy at an international symposium on the borderline, and a patient, and with psychoanalytic treatment, and I introduced DBT for the first time in that community, in that meeting, and getting up and giving a talk with no preparation because that was where we were on the hierarchy. I swear to God, after I did that to 150 Italian psychologists alongside my American colleagues with no preparation and found that actually I gave a better talk than usual. I mean, from what people said, though, I was filled with real fear while I did it.
Yeah.
I was irreversibly changed. It's one of the few things I can say in my life was actually I created a new pathway because I was a sucker enough to follow this behavior therapist's recommendations right to the end. I mean, I just did the whole thing because I believed, okay, I want to change this. And lo and behold, it really, really changed. Gave me a kind of a freedom that I didn't have before. To me, that skills training and that's exposure and that's cognitive therapy and it's probably contingency management, and it's kind of like, it's what change is, one way or another. It's creating a new pathway, doing it, and finding out that it works. It's kind of simple in a way.
Well, you know, but one key element, and this is my read of the a group of us in the learning community I facilitate have been reading all of the exposure literature, and this I heard also at ABCT. But the key part of what you were just saying, it actually matters that you are in the relevant context, that you've got the emotion up, that you are in fact activated. Talking about playing golf is different than actually hitting the ball. And so I think this behavioral rehearsal piece, in increasingly realistic context, you know, getting so that the behavior really will generalize, that I think matters, especially if you're a person who struggles with dysregulation, that you really can pull off important behaviors when you're dysregulated, or you can get yourself, you know, re-regulated enough to then do the next step. But I think that behavioral rehearsal in the face of high emotion is turning out to look really important.
No, you know, because
in the context.
Because even
not
if you do it,
about it,
if you do it in virtual exposure, if you do it in a group, if you do it by talking about it, it is true that no matter what you do like that, you still are never convinced it'll work until you're doing it in the context. The realistic context and where you actually experience all of that trouble, all the fear. And you really, it's only there. It's only when riding the horse, not the hobby horse, you know, and not talking about the horse and not the virtual horse. It's when you're actually on a horse and you are learning you can ride through the woods on a horse when you never thought you could before, that nails it in a way that nothing else does. And I think we do forget that. I'll just say one. I feel like I'm on a little bit of a, you tell me to shut up if I'm saying too much, but
no, I want to hear what else you got on the skill stuff, if there's more. Or
I'll say something more, but one of the effects it's had on me, or else this is where I got to in about skills, that sets the stage for how I read all of this, is that in my actual work with patients, I would say that the boundary in individual therapy between when I am doing, quote, skills training and when I'm not has dissolved. So that when I'm in sessions, I no longer think, oh, this DBT individual patient will learn the skills in the skills group and I will reinforce them. I just never assume that anymore. I assume
yeah.
that'll be one venue where they may get something going in there, and it'll depend on a lot of factors, like who's sitting opposite them in the group could totally ruin it. But with me in the office, I mean, if we get to a point where I think they need these seven skills, we just do them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yeah. kind of just blends in. And I find, so I'm finding that the original way that you would have thought Marsha Linehan would have gone with DBT when she started would have been like other behavior therapists. She would have just incorporated the skills into the necessary relationship in individual therapy. When people needed them, you would teach them and you would reinforce them and you would make sure they happened and you would talk about them. And it was that moment in the history of the development of DBT when she decided to break it out into skills groups. And I think I'm just recovering from that moment. It makes me, I think, a more integrated therapist, but I'm not sure I could have gotten here without having done a ton of skills training separately. Or
that's
so-called skills
key.
Training. Yeah.
Well,
how
I think,
do you get
you know, there's a stretch on, you know, as a supervisor on some of our research trials at the University of Washington. And there was this moment at during early on when we're in the training phase for training up the therapist where we realized the individual therapist actually did not know the skills. So, you know, you are a little bit different in that regard in terms of your history and experience.
Yeah, well, as a psychoanalytic therapist at the beginning, to me, the beginning of DBT was, oh, my God, look at these skills. I mean, I already felt I knew a lot about individual therapy, though it turns out I didn't know how it would be specifically practiced in DBT, but the skills was the newest part. So, Kelly, as you know, because I emailed you in advance, I'm going to sing a song about
right
skills.
Now.
I wrote it today. I'm going to sing it right now. You never know, you know. But, you know, I did a song, one of these, and I read a little story of another one. So it's fun for me if it happens to come together. So today I thought, you know, I'm thinking a lot about skills. I should write a song and put it in my DBT songbook. So I think you'll be able to tell what the tune is, but I'll say what it is. It's to Home on the Range. You know Home on the Range?
I do.
Okay. Can you stop laughing so I can sing this? Are you laughing?
I'll mute my phone. That's what I'll do. I'll mute my phone.
Okay. This is about skills, and if you know the DBT skills, you'll hear references to all four modules as it goes along. Okay. Well, I don't have any background music, but here we go. Oh, give me a skill instead of a pill when negative feelings are here. With something to do, I can navigate through sadness, shame, anger, and fear. Please help me to see just what I can do to get free of acts and beliefs that while giving relief, hurt my self-efficacy. When life is a test and I'm sorely distressed and I can't tolerate one more day, I need skills to survive through a crisis alive so I don't throw my whole life away. Please give me a clue for accepting what's painful but true, to distract and self-soothe, and this moment improve, till the worst of the feelings pass through. Can you possibly show me how to say no? I never learned how it should be. I can't get it right. I end up in a fight, or I give up what matters to me. Please help me to know effectively how to say no, using dear man give fast so my friendships can last without sacrificing my goal. So help me to find my way to wise mind where emotions and reason are paired, where discouraging words just fly by like birds, and they know if I'm scared, I'm just scared. Observe and describe. Participate brings me alive. One thing at a time, leave the judgment behind, and finally just do what works. That's it.
Woo, woo, woo!
You there?
I love it.
Oh, God. So,
that is fabulous.
It's so fun for me to do that. And often when I do this kind of thing, I actually... Really, you really have to think and put it together. You learn things. You know, you actually have to figure out what the essence is of what you want to say. Let me one other comment, and then we'll go on about an audience. It's so weird to sing. It's one thing just you and me to talk to each other, but to sing a song and then you just have nothing in response. So thank you for cheering. But
I was clapping. Yes,
you're clapping. Thank you. I mean, but you know, the fact that you and I continue to get almost zero feedback about this. Now, I can't say totally zero because I have gotten an email recently from somebody I know who listens and who looks forward to it every time. But also there was that at the ABCT meeting, as you know, because I brought the person over to you, there was somebody there who said she totally loves to listen and wouldn't miss one. So... God, I just want to encourage people to go ahead and email us through Perry Hoffman or any ABTPD. It's just great to know, and including it would be good to know if there are things that you want to hear more about.
I had an idea we should talk about with Perry is about creating some sort of Facebook page or something.
I thought you were going to say an opera. A Facebook page. We should do an opera. Have a Facebook
page. You
know,
I heard at ABCT about a treatment for that, Charlie, that particular
time. What? Don't tell me it yet. I'm not ready to change. Facebook page.
Or something where we could actually have a little bit of, I wouldn't mind having it open, and we could see comments right, live even, or... Anyway, we'll talk with Perry because I agree with you.
Let's talk about that because it would be nice. It's a long gap between these conversations. You had other things. I have a couple other things I wanted to tell you about. But
let's hear it. What else do you got?
Well, one thing was, and you said this is one where I'm not sure I fully understand, but it's one of those things where I feel like it's really important. And it was in the Is It DBT part, and it was Milton Brown.
Yeah,
isn't Milton now in San Diego, or where is
That's
Milton?
Right.
No, he
yeah,
is.
San Diego.
He's in San Diego.
Yeah.
Anyway, when he gave his talk on resonant frequency breathing, I thought at first, and I had read a little article about it before. It's one of those million little things you read, and it sounds really kind of interesting, and it bridges the gap between physiology, neurophysiology, and and body physiology, and breathing activity, and mindfulness, and all these different things. Think, this is a neat little synthesis. But actually, when I heard him present this time, I thought, this seems like a big deal somehow. I don't know within it what will be the biggest deal, but here was my understanding of it, and I wonder if you have a similar one or if we just want to take it further.
Yeah, spend some time on it. Yeah, I think. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I think the idea first. I think the idea follows from that, or it's associated to the idea that the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system, sort of the parallel to the sympathetic nervous system, the fight-flight nervous system, that there is a parasympathetic nervous system in the body, and the vagus nerve, which goes down to the heart and sort of slows the heart down, is part of it. It's probably the biggest single nerve in the parasympathetic nervous system, but there's much more to it than that. And apparently the parasympathetic nervous system is associated with kind of coming down from intense affect and being able to sort of stay a little bit down, and I start to wonder to what degree might this have to do with the problem in the biosocial theory of borderline personality disorder in DBT, the part that says, once you get your emotions up and activated, there's a slow return to baseline. Because it apparently one way to get a return to baseline is the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system and the vagus nerve. So that, the skill that Marcia added in the last couple years to DBT of the dive reflex of putting ice water on your face and how that activates in mammals the parasympathetic nervous system, which kind of brings affect down or puts a floor under it. Whatever it exactly is will probably be, it's probably much more known than I know yet about it. But so anyway, starting with that, then I think where this is that is there a certain kind of way to get that to happen? Like, for instance, progressive muscle relaxation has always been thought of a way to relax and to bring the blood pressure and heart rate down, bring breathing to a slower level, et cetera, and sort of reduce anxiety as a result. And so in this presentation, he's talking about a more much more specific thing to do, which is resonant frequency breathing. What he means by that, as I understood it, is that you want to get your breathing down to a certain slower and deeper pace, usually about 6 breaths per minute, which would be like 6 in-breaths and 6 out-breaths. And where your breath, the out-breath, the exhalation, is like diaphragmatic breathing. It's longer. So let's say you breathe in for 4 seconds and you breathe out for 6 seconds. You kind of gradually bring your breathing down to something like that, and where it's deeper breathing, so it fills your lungs out to the alveoli, and as a result, it actually comes, it creates a very deep and important relationship between the heart and the heart rate and breathing and the whole vasculature and blood pressure of the body, so that in the studying of different types of breathing, what he was reporting at that was that, you know, when you get down to a certain frequency of breathing that's about right for you, it starts to get in sync, so that as you breathe out, your blood pressure, your heart rate goes down significantly while you're breathing out. As you breathe in, your heart rate goes up, and that tends to happen anyway. But what he was showing is that when you get it so that you've got this kind of sine wave, this up and down of the heart rate that's in sync with the in and out of the breath at this certain slow pace, that it activates the parasympathetic nervous system, which can generate better emotion regulation. For instance, it might be one of those things, alluding back to something you said, might be one of those things that would help you tolerate a more intense level of emotion about something and still just be able to be there, maybe if you're still doing resonant frequency breathing rather than just relaxation, while you while you expose yourself to a cue that sets off intense emotion. So you might, you could start to imagine exposure treatment with assisted by resonant frequency breathing, or something else assisted by resonant frequency breathing. And so, you know, I think I've discovered it on my own during meditating many times and maybe during relaxation, but it isn't like I've been going after that type of breathing for its own sake, thinking that there's any special value to it. But does that, you know, I know you said earlier
I was there for
you
that,
think
too.
This is, you think it's accurate what the way I'm putting it, or do you want to modify how I'm explaining it?
No, I thought you did a great job, and I think that the ability to train it was also interesting. Milton laid out this sort of software that could give you, in essence, biofeedback so that you could learn to get yourself in sync. But what is interesting, even as you're talking and explaining it, I'm slowing my breathing down. I bet every single person listening is slowing their breathing down.
Oh, my God.
And I think it's so accessible. Like, it's always present. And so if there was a way to do something, what he was suggesting, I thought, was, you know, to really in a way make this an essential skill we all had, train it up, and then it's right there. You can use it. I thought, I was real excited about it.
Yeah, I think he's on to something important. I mean, with all the, obviously people have come more and more to think that breathing, I mean, I was recently reading a book by Barry Walsh, his latest book on treatment of self-mutilation or self-injurious behavior, and Barry has a huge section in there on a whole bunch of different types of breathing that speaks to this. And it's sort of like, you know, reading and or working with Thich Nhat Hanh or any other practitioner, the amount of focus on the breath. I think it's interesting to start to specify as much as possible what are we doing from a scientific point of view. It's really a neat opportunity. I really like that Milton's doing that.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Hey, so we have about 10 minutes. What do you got still left? The one thing I was thinking as I looked through my list is some of Liz Hembree's little tips that I found helpful for doing exposure therapy. I just thought some of her metaphors and such were pretty useful. But
I was going to say something but I don't know that we need to do this, but I thought, usually I just think I'm like talking to you, and I know you already know this, but I wanted to keep getting the word out about this adolescent study, was I just thought so important. So I might just say something about it briefly, but I want to hear. I'm always
more. Well, maybe since it builds on the skill idea that we were just on, it might be a good time for the stuff from Hembree.
Yeah,
so
you go ahead.
This workshop on prolonged exposure, which is a treatment to help people who have traumatic experiences that are really interfering. They either relive them or they have a lot of avoidance behavior. And one of the cool things that she was, the purpose of the workshop was talking about how much more than just fear should be processed. So in prolonged exposure, the idea is you tell the story and then you really tell the story again, and you really stay. And what was cool, she had this metaphor. Let me see if I can tell it well. She had that often in a traumatic experience, the way that memory gets laid down is like you had a bunch of sheets of paper, a story in a book or something, that were strewn across the room in not a particular order. It's not organized in a coherent narrative. So, sometimes the first time you try to tell somebody the story, there'll be, just flashes of very intense memory, and you might not even remember, did that happen first, but then how did that, so there's this way that creating the narrative of the story itself, getting it into an organized fashion, is like picking up all the pages of the book. And I thought that was a really, at least for me, that was a very helpful metaphor. And then the other she had was she's saying that having PTSD is a lot like having a book where it's just in your house and sometimes it falls open to a particular page where there's this horrible paragraph and you slam it shut. And the problem is that book is your life. there's important things in there. And that what she thinks about this is that imaginal exposure is being able to go through and read the book together kind of again and again, listening to yourself read the book until really the you can read all of it, and that is some of the pages in the book, but it's not the whole book. I just thought that there's a way that she was able to put words to how talking about a trauma in a way that's different, that is not the way that we typically process, but where you really do read paragraph by paragraph, sometimes sentence by sentence, and organizing them, that's different than how we typically process our traumatic memories. So that was really interesting. And then the other little tidbit that I found really helpful, she said she tends to think, why has this person not recovered? And I thought, what's in the way? And she showed a lot of different clips. And what you saw, there's one woman where I get teary even thinking about her. She, just the courage that's involved in facing these traumatic experiences is so moving. But what you saw with this person was the thing that had gotten in her way was the shame she felt about it. And so what Lib was talking about was as you're processing traumatic experiences is really to think, why has this person not recovered from this trauma? What are the emotions that are in the way? And so really helping the person talk and work through those is as important as fear and avoidance behaviors. But that is a really, I thought it was a very good workshop that she did.
I like that a lot. It's, you know, it sounds like a lot of the things that a lot of good exposure therapists would agree on, but that way of explaining it, with those kind of metaphors, I find evocative. I'm thinking of people that I've worked with myself. I'm thinking of, you know, so many people. I think it all comes together when you write it down or when you tell it as a story. And I often find with people that I work with at the beginning where I am just blown away by what they have to cope with on a daily basis and how this comes up and then this comes up and then this comes up. And each thing is just in its own right so hard to get through. And then how, if things go reasonably, while it takes time, like a year later, it really has like all those pieces, all those pages that you're talking about, the sheets of paper. Now you can go through the story more and more. There's a story, and it still has a lot of pain in it, but it actually holds together. And I think just that fact of it becoming coherent is a huge comfort, even if it's just only a piece of getting where you need to go. It's very good. I went to one workshop. I wish I remembered exactly who it was. You know how you go in for a while to one and then you walk out. There was one I went into for a while. It was about the use of metaphors, stories, and, I forget. The theme was, how do you deepen the impact and memory of a therapy session that's valuable? And that they spent the whole time on that. And one person talked about a variety, you know, the role of metaphor and the role of telling stories, or just the role of being dramatic and just really underlining a point by being dramatic. And I think one of the things that some forms of therapy training drill out of people, because you're trying to do it by the book, or you're trying to do it the way a supervisor says, or you're trying to just kind of like not say something too upsetting, you lose so much of an opportunity to just kind of like do things or say things in a way that people, you know, like, I should probably be writing and say, actually, this came up. One of the therapists in this was talking about how his mentor used to sing songs to patients. Patients would never forget it. Oh, my God. We have like 4 minutes.
Tell me about the DBT for adolescents. I really
just say in a word, because, you know, this will get published. It isn't published. It's just data now that's been pulled together and presented. But it's so exciting for those people, myself included, who've been involved in doing adolescent treatment for a while and with their families, that, you know, they really, in, it's an international study, but based in Oslo, Norway, and where they really systematically and with really, it sounds like good methodology, including really solid measurement of adherence to DBT measures with, you know, the best available measures. I mean, including having one of their own team translate the Marshall Linehan's adherence manual into Norwegian so that they were doing it all there. Anyway, so they had really good adherence, and they worked with all these adolescents, and they had two groups. They had the ones that did DBT for adolescents in the same model as Alec Miller and his colleagues have developed, which included, you know, a family group with family skills training, with including the fifth module, the middle path skills module, and then comparing it to what he called enhanced usual care, which was either a psychodynamic or cognitive behavioral therapy, usually, but not DBT, and medication and other things, but not skills training, and then compared the two groups over time, and the big story was just what you, if you were Alec Miller and other people who have done this model, would hope would come out, which is really solid, statistically very significant findings about reduction of self-harm, reduction of suicide attempts, and reduction of various emotional states, depression, anxiety, and anger, and just better functioning for their teenagers, and lots of good, you know, outcomes. So I just think I just wanted to say it's out there. People should watch for it. The guy's name is Mehlum, Lars Mehlum, Mehlum. It is not published yet, and it really is just a good sign. And now there's a major study going on, you know, that Seattle and Marsha Linehan's involved with, and it's also down at UCLA, looking at a lot of adolescents. Again, it'll be a large study, and what the outcomes of that will be very important also. So I think we finally see, everybody I think has just assumed, oh yeah, adolescent DBT is a good thing, you know, it's been around, there's a book on it, there's studies, but there's never been a randomized controlled study that actually shows a difference under blind and controlled conditions.
Cool. Well, Charlie, we're at time.
We're at the time.
So we are on for what is our next date?
You know, I sent an email out. Yeah, you probably got it because it was minutes before we got on air. Oh, you did?
The 13th. Amazing. How about the 13th, shall we
say? How about January 13th? If Kelly is okay with that, January 13th would work.
Perry said she could do either, so I think we're good.
She did? Oh, okay. So let's do our next one the 13th. You and I will put our heads together and pick a topic. Again, and we could talk about that Facebook idea. Oh, and I want to tell people, if anybody wanted to see a copy of that song that I sang, because this came up before when I did another song, Perry asked if I would post it to her. And I already sent it to her today when I finished it. And she said it's on the website already, in the upper right-hand corner. Oh, Give Me a Skill is the name of the song. And so give us some feedback. Give me some feedback. And January 13th. And you know, thank you, Kelly. Thanks. We didn't get to
really
talk
great.
About as much, but that's the best. It's great to do this.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear what you saw. Okay, Charlie.
All right.
See you in January. Good night, all.
See you in January. Good night, everybody. Bye bye.
Bye bye.